Hello and welcome to this PSG Think Big series podcast. In this program, Alicia Seckham speaks to Sanusha Naidu on the lead-up to the elections, the potential coalitions, predicted outcomes and possible impact on South Africa.
Hello and welcome to the Think Big series brought to you by PSG. I'm Alicia Seckham. Well, with much frustration around South Africa's socio-economic progress or lack thereof, 30 years into democracy, there's great anticipation and an expectation that things are going to change at the polls come the 29th of May, that they have to. Back in 2019, the ANC won around 57% of the vote. And this time, predictions are that the ANC's share of the vote could fall below 50% for the first time since it won the first post-apartheid vote in 1994. Admittedly, we have seen some shifts in the political landscape already. So where does this new political climate take economic policy and the implementation thereof moving forward? And will it be enough to actually turn things around? Joining me now is political analyst Sanusha Naidu. She's a senior research associate with the Institute of Global Dialogue. So we can get a better understanding of where we're at and where we're potentially headed. Sanusha, thanks so much for joining us today. And right at the top, I mean, it's not just what the opinion polls are reflecting, right? Local government elections have already acted as somewhat of a precursor, pointing to the ANC vote falling below 50% in these upcoming elections. Roughly a month to go. Is that what you're pricing in?
Oh, nice to be on the show. Thank you very much to yourself and PSG. I think where we are pricing this in, from my perspective, is really not in the sense of what the drop of the ANC's election results would be like at the polls after May 29th. The big question is, how big will be the decline? Will it be bigger than 50%? So around about what some polls have suggested, around 38, 39, 40, depending at what stage you take the poll. And also in terms of, you know, what were the big events at the time that may have influenced voters to say, I'm not going to vote for the ANC, or my vote is not necessarily going to go to any other political party. So those are some of the underlying dynamics of polling and what we need to take into account in with regard to variables. But the one issue I think is very critical is that percentage you're raising. Is it going to be just less than 50% or just much more than less than 50%. So if it's around 40%, if that's where the poll is, it does make it a very, very big dilemma for the ANC. If it's around 48, 49%, and this is where I'm leaning towards that just a less than 50% percentage. So I think what's going to happen in this election is that the ANC is going to lose support, but lose support in a manner that enables it to try and negotiate with the smaller political parties. Some of the trajectories that we are picking up, or I am picking up on, is suggesting that the ANC will make 50%. Now, I'm not going to put my head on the block and say, yes, that's the done deal here. But I think that this is so much of a gambled election in terms of the fact that we are playing a lot of lotto here with this election in terms of how we are defining what the percentage results would be like. And the bigger challenge for this election is that this is the most unpredictable election in South Africa's history.
Yeah. Despite that, and having said all of that, Sanusha, is the ANC still caught in the trappings of a too big to fail mentality, you know, still complacent with its power of the past, or is it very much awake to what is potentially a turning of the tide?
It's a very difficult one to assess, Alicia, because I think that when the ANC speaks, its rhetoric tends to suggest that we are too big to fail, that we can, in other words, it's not even we too big to fail, is that we cannot fail, full stop. And the problem with that is that mental approach to the fact that we are your liberation struggle movement. We are the ones that brought democratization to South Africa. We liberated you. And if you listen to the ANC, whether you're listening to President Ramaphosa, whether you're listening to the General Secretary, when you go to these rallies and you listen to the rhetoric, it's very much a chauvinistic rhetoric in terms of the fact that we are the ones that liberated you, so we cannot fail. And I think what they haven't actually attuned and acclimatized themselves to is the fact that There comes a moment in your liberation struggle history where you have to start thinking about the tide turning. The tide has turned in South Africa for the ANC. So the bigger challenge for the ANC is, one, accepting, but at the same time, I think within the inner sanctum of the ANC, there's a lot of dilemmas that are kind of circling around. There's a lot of uncertainty, unpredictability, because then they're not just dealing with the fact that they may no longer be the 50 plus party in terms of an election or a ruling party in power, but they have to deal with their kind of contentious opponents, which are coming out of themselves, out of the party itself.
Absolutely. And all of that born out of what is a persistent internal battle, it seems, between, you know, the centrists, the pragmatists and the populists that sit within the ANC that seemingly constrained Ramaphosa's ability to lead decisively, Sanusha. And this is exactly what, as I said, you know, helped provide a fertile ground for this proliferation of new parties with potentially new solutions to the challenges the country continues to face. But let's face it, we've seen new political parties burst onto the political scene before. We've seen the ANC start an election campaign with relatively low polling numbers before. And we've watched those numbers rise significantly in the last few days before the election, and that allowing for, you know, a bit of an ANC comeback. So what's to say it's going to be any different this time around?
This time around, Alicia, it's an unpredictable result, which is why I think so many of us, from the civil society to academia, to government, to business, to diplomatic missions across the board, are so kind of seized with this election, because this election is not a done deal at the moment. It's not an election that you can sit back and say, even if I don't go out to vote, the ANC will still come into power. Because it makes it much more vulnerable, volatile, and also unpredictable and complex. So I think that's the first part of the answer. The second part of the answer is we have in our electoral landscape a high percentage, if I'm not mistaken, and I stand corrected on this, you've got about a third of the electorate, this is registered voters, who are uncertain of what they're going to do. And that makes this election unpredictable. So you as a political party, whether you're the ANC, whether you're the DA, you cannot sit back on your laurels and think, oh, yes, my vote is going to come out to vote. Because the trend has been from 2019, from 2014, even in local government elections in 2021, is that certain of the voters that have not come out to vote have been from political parties. But they haven't gone to opposition parties. So they also don't see the opposition as being viable as an alternative. So I think this election, in terms of saying, but it'll be business as usual. It would not be business as usual. It's going to be unpredictable. You're not sure what's going to happen. And most importantly, I think the only way you will be able to get a sense or modicum of what our election outcome will look like is a week before the election, if you have a poll where people give you some kind of indication and inclination of their voter behavior. But up until now, I think the electorate is keeping their vote close to their chest.
Absolutely. Look, many saying this is part of the democratic process, right? That the Constitution always envisioned a multi-party democracy. But as you say, it presents this other layer of complexity, a very fragmented political landscape. And so there's a lot of apprehension as well, a fear that more parties are going to result in more volatility, more fractious politics as well. The numbers are unfathomable, Sanusha. So I want you to make some sense of it for us, because we're looking at three different ballots, a complex voting structure where we're looking at, you know, what, 52 political parties on the national ballot, the national regional ballot holding anything between 30 and 45 parties. Then you've got a provisional ballot to consider as well. I mean, this is a very complex voting structure that we're looking at with a whole lot of bureaucracy. And I don't know, it makes voting choices even more unclear. Or is it just me?
No, it's not you. It's me as well. And it's my mother as well, who's very worried about what her vote's going to mean. But no, it is. It is a complex election. It's a complex voting system and voting process. And that's because of the fact that now you've had the amendment of the Electoral Act, which adds allows for independent candidates to stand, not on the national ballot list, which is called the national compensatory list, but to stand on the national regional compensatory list, which is really the percentage of votes that parties get to have seats in the National Assembly. So that's the regional to national, which used to be provincial to national. Now we're calling it regional to national. And then, of course, you have your third ballot paper, which is the normal ballot paper that you and I would vote in our respective provinces for, which is for the provincial legislature and to vote for your party that will be in control. I think what's really challenging for voters today is that there's been so much of attention paid to getting the Electoral Amendment Act sorted out, being so late in terms of the parliamentary committee that was tasked with that under the constitutional court ruling that said that independents are constitutionally enabled to have a seat in the National Assembly, that became much more convoluted in the process. So there hasn't been enough education. And I think the IEC has tried, but there hasn't been enough voter or civic education, and civil society has tried. But I think everything has become so kind of caught up in the maelstrom of getting things to this election, getting everything right, the technical, the infrastructure, the ballot boxes, getting finalizing your ballot papers, which is still haven't been finalized because we have the Jacob Zuma saga. And the appeal of that that has gone to the Constitutional Court. So we're still waiting. So I think the complexity of this election is that we may see, and this is one issue that we have to think about as we go into the final 100-meter sprint for this election, is whether voters will say, well, there's 52 parties on the national ballot. There's anything between, as you said, between 30 to 45 at the provincial level and on the regional ballot. They're not different. The regional ballot, most of the parties are not different on the regional ballot and on the provincial ballot. They may end up in a situation which circles back to your original, your previous point about, you know, will the ANC then find comfort in this election? And that is, people may say, well, let me vote for the devil I know rather than the devil I don't know. So they may end up going back to traditional base and say, you know what? I'll vote ANC because all the others, I don't know. There will be some exceptions. For example, if you look at the ballots, on all of the ballot papers, the three ballot papers, you've got parties that are there at the national, regional, and provincial level. So a party like the Nkonse Sizwe party could be the big disruptor for the ANC in particular provinces and could actually have a number of seats in the National Assembly, both on the national ballot and the regional ballot, just sitting there and eyeing out the ANC as an opposition party.
Absolutely, which brings us to the question, and I'm going to ask this almost as a side note, what value do the independents bring to the table here?
If I can be not facetious and just say, I'm not sure, because I think that going onto a ballot as an independent candidate requires immense resources, both financial and non-financial. I looked at one of the independent candidate posters in the Western Cape. It doesn't have anything. It doesn't say. I mean, obviously, you could debate, you know, when Musima Emani with his party says a job in every household, you'd be like, yeah, what does that mean, a job in every household? But there is a tagline in this poster. With the one that I saw, there's no tagline. It's just the person's picture, their name, and vote.
Absolutely.
And that tells you how expensive it is to contest an election. So we have 11 independent candidates. There's one independent candidate that features in almost all of the national regional ballots, which tells me that that person has a lot of resources.
Yeah, a lot of resources, but whether they can shift the needle on anything if elected.
To be candid and honest, my sense is that you get a seat as an independent candidate. However, you're not going to shift the policy domain. You're not going to change the legislative dynamics. You're not going to make that impact because you need to have a caucus. And what is your caucus in Parliament?
Absolutely. So question mark there, right? Of those party manifestos that you have managed to look through, Sanusha, and I know there's a lot of them, is there enough transparency and credibility in the party's internal structures and what they stand for?
Well, I think this time around, there's been a little attempt by the bigger parties. And of course, the smaller parties will kind of use their regionalism to define their manifestos and their election strategy and identity. But the bigger parties, you're looking at the ANC, you're looking at the DA, you're looking at EFF, and I think the newer parties like Rise Mzansi, Build One South Africa with Musi Maimane, and of course we can't ignore the MKP, the Mkhonto Sizwe Party. You kind of get the sense that they have gone for the more structural dilemmas in the country. They're speaking about education. They're speaking about security and safety. They're speaking about unemployment, the economy, etc. The problem, however, is that my sense is that they have essentially extracted this from what they've seen as their polls and said, well, this is what the key issues are for the electorate, and this is what we need to talk about. They haven't, in my opinion, went out and said the how. If you are going to create, let me give you one example. If you're going to create a job in every household, how do you do that? What needs to change? You have an economy that's stagnant. You have an economy that is very vulnerable to external shocks and internal shocks. You have the fact of the matter is that our currency is volatile, and that means your economic growth path is not going to be achieved in the context of growth through the kind of employment creation. So if you're not creating growth, you're not creating employment, you need to do something to basically shift the orientation of your economy. How are you going to create a job in every household? Then, of course, there's the question of the language. I've noted that now the language of creating job opportunities is not the same as creating a job. So the point I'm trying to make here is that sometimes the language has become like what the RDP document language has become. And that is, if you say every community needs to have access to running water, you change the parenthesis in the RDP document and you put it within a comma here and an exclamation mark there. And then it becomes, well, if you have a tap in your yard, which is 500 or 200 or 600 meters from your homestead, that's running water. And running water is not doesn't mean that it has to flow. It can be a trickle. So we're beginning to see language in election strategy documents and manifestos almost kind of overlapping each other in that way. And so job opportunities are becoming a key thing. The third point I want to make is I didn't really find anything exciting about what coalitions are going to be like in these.
Okay, so I'm going to pause you there because we're going to get into coalitions in just a bit. But something that stands out for me from all that you've said to this point, and I always say this, when it comes to crafting an agenda that will ensure stability over time, this is why the opposition parties seem to fail, right? Because they seem to not have a strategy that moves beyond simply capitalizing on the discontent. That said, there is a populist appeal that can't be ignored. I mean, the MK Party, with its very brief manifesto, Sanusha, is certainly proof of that. As the wild card in these elections, how much of a game changer is the MK Party, especially considering that Jacob Zuma is now a parliamentary candidate?
Well, I think it's going to be a big kind of thorn in the side of not just the ANC. I think it also has kind of compelled political parties like Rise Mzansi, like EFF, and even perhaps to a certain extent the IFP in KZN to say, how do we actually deal with this MKP? Because MKP, as you rightly point out, shows that you don't have to have a kind of sophisticated election strategy. You can go out on populist mode, you can go out in appealing to populist feelings, and you can start riling up your support. But that's the point, right? Once you get that support, what do you do with it? And the intention is, what is the end game for this MKP? And some people have argued, and I think there's a level of credibility, or there's a level of substance to this point, is that perhaps the MKP doesn't want to actually go into parliament as a party that says we are going to do this and this. It wants to sit in parliament to say we're going to rile up the ANC in every way. And it's a basic way in which you continue to nip at the heels of the ANC and keep pushing them in the terms of where they are. So that's the one angle of this. The second angle of this is maybe the control of KZN. And this is where I think there's going to be critical. You know, there's tensions in KZN. There's questions about whether the ANC has dropped the ball in KZN. There's challenges. But also remember, KZN has some very important infrastructure. It has ports. It has the economic corridors. It links up to particular markets. So that's going to be key as well in terms of what happens to a province like KZN, where if the MK party comes into play and does get a sizable amount of the provincial vote, what goes on in there? And of course, the vote in terms of the regional to national. I think the end game as well is really understanding what the strategy of your opponents are. And right now, what is happening with parties across the spectrum is that each are trying to undo the other by trying to pick at their heels without necessarily saying, I'm not that. This is what I got to offer. And I'm going to give you something much more pragmatic.
Absolutely. So at this point now, you open the door to coalitions, right? Let's run with the premise that the ANC is going to lose its majority and that we are going to see some kind of realignment. We've seen a pre-election deal struck already, a group of parties led by the DA signing up to what's being called the multi-party charter for South Africa. If together they get more than 50% of the seats, they've already agreed to form this coalition, right? So how does this work out? Does it work?
Alicia, I think the challenge in that is that the devil is in the detail in the MPC, because you can have one Snow White and seven dwarfs in that MPC. And the problem with that is that the way it has been crafted, it's that first, let's see how each of us do as independent political parties. And once we decide that, we'll then come to back together as the Moonshot Pact, if that's what it's still called. And we will then decide how we want to define this coalition. There's already cracks in that coalition, in that MPC. There's already cracks with the way Action SA reacts to the DA, with the way in which, for example, the ACDP reacts to perhaps to Action SA, Freedom Front Plus. I mean, in the Western Cape, there's challenges being raised about whether the Freedom Front Plus is going to do better than the DA in particular wards, in particular districts, in particular regions of the province. Then, of course, you have those that are outside of that MPC, and those are parties like the Patriotic Alliance, which has been doing really well on the outskirts of the Cape Metro. Now, What has happened in the last couple of days is the PA, the Patriotic Alliance, has gone into a kind of loose configuration, a confederation or configuration of a coalition with smaller community-based parties. These are parties that haven't necessarily cut and made the cut on the ballot paper to contest, whether at a regional or at the national level, but they may be sitting at the provincial level. We don't know. I will have to go back and check. But these parties are not there. So what the PA has done is that the PA has gone and very smartly said, stand with us. These people that are outside of the electoral space, whether they are formally outside of the electoral space in terms of not appearing on a ballot paper, can now shape that PA support in areas like Oudtshoorn and outside of the Cape Metro, in the Cape Winelands, out on Robinson, in Beaufort West, in what you call this, the Karoo, etc., where they are community-based political organizations that will then try and say, well, this is what you do, support the PA. We in a loose confederation with them. This is why this election is so, so unpredictable, because the coalition doesn't have to be formal anymore. The question is, what does the PA get? It gets the support for the election in these areas. And when you listen to the leader of the PA, he's very confident that he's coming in into this province and perhaps at the national level with a lot of vigor and a lot of support. So for political parties like the ANC and the DA, I think they've got to be careful as well. There's an interesting debate that also happened about whether the best coalition in the country is a coalition between the ANC and the DA. And that coalition would be the kind of dream coalition that business and civil society and everybody would like, because you kind of have the two biggest parties in the country working together for the benefit of the country. You don't have
you
to
say a dream coalition, but I mean, history's shown that parties looking to govern by, you know, forging unity by the number of votes and seats needed rather than ideological compatibility tend to fragment when they're confronted by fundamental, political or economic crisis. And with that, you know, the uncertainty of a coalition government like that is a significant political, if not economic, risk as well.
That's because of the way the structure of the electoral system is defined. Because the way we have structured our electoral system is that everybody feels they can get past the post first. It's a winner take all. And that is why your architecture and your design of coalitions is built on that identity that first I win, then I talk. And that in itself is the dilemma and the crisis of why we are here where we are today. Now, what I heard at the weekend, or what I heard yesterday, is the mayor of Ekurhuleni, the new mayor — we know that they've been through many mayors — the new mayor said, well, he reached out to the DA for a coalition. The problem with this is that both sides have non-negotiable stances. They're not willing to compromise on key issues. The best way to describe this is to say, well, if this ANC is the CEO, let the DA be the CFO. And in a way, you get the dynamics working together, because it's a win-win for everybody. But unfortunately, your way you have articulated the thinking of electoral democracy is that we must first win, then we talk. And that's the problem of coalitions, that coalitions have become fragile in an electoral system that is fragile in itself. So as you rightly point out, because everybody wants to win seats in the National Assembly based on the proportional representation, et cetera, you then have these challenges. But where it becomes really important is if you think about local government elections. And you think about local government, and you think about what happens at the local government. If you start thinking about the coalition there and how it builds up to the national, you then have to think about the layers of an electoral system. And the layers of an electoral system in South Africa is that we have local government elections, we have a provincial government, and we have a national government. It's a duplication of services and a bureaucracy that's heavily red taped. So in many ways, what we are trying to think about, what I think we should be trying to think about, is how do we come to an electoral system that enables coalitions to coexist and to exist in a manner that talks to the fact that you have to now start talking about electoral strategies around economic development, around job creation, around politics, and working together, as opposed to saying, I sit outside the MPC. And then once I get my votes, I then come back into the MPC. By that time, it's all fragile.
Absolutely. And I mean, like you say, even where there's commentary now that you've got the EFF, the MK party, and the ANC potentially natural allies, it doesn't necessarily work. And we've seen it at, you know, the municipal level, where we've seen the EFF and the ANC try to co-govern, metropolitans like Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni, and not proving to be successful there. What is interesting, Sanusha, is that, you know, two of the new parties of interest, Build One South Africa nor Rise Mzansi, have associated with any party or coalition slate. I mean, each has seemed to maintain their own independence. Is that a better strategy? What are they bringing into this equation?
I think for them, they don't want to get caught up in the coalition itself before the election can happen. And I can understand that from the perspective of both the party executives, because I think they want to also understand what their traction is in this spectrum of the electoral landscape. And it's their right. I mean, nobody has to force them to do anything that they don't want to do. And it's their right. Is it a smart strategy? I think it's a strategic strategy, in a sense that they want to be able to understand where they fit. The one thing I have to say about coalitions in South Africa, Alicia, is that they've become extremely transactional. Transactional in a sense, in terms of, what do I get out of this? So if I give you my one seat, what do I get out of it? And that's also the other reason why coalitions aren't working. A final point I want to make is this election, I think for me, has very real security dilemmas. and security dilemmas, not only in the context of the of what we saw the MK party starting to do, challenging the credibility, legitimacy, and authenticity of the IEC to run this election, but also security in terms of how do we ensure that the ballot box is secure? And and are we going to see, for example, the NAC joints, the National Joint Security sort of formation, the NAC joints that have been formed by the president, come out and play a critical role, including the SANDF, playing a critical role in making sure that this election has a level of security that can protect this integrity of the election?
And then beyond that, bottom line, where are your confidence levels sitting when it comes to implementation and enforcement of the new rules of engagement that will actually be needed to shift the way the country is governed?
Well, for me, I'm a bit more apprehensive of what Parliament will look like. I know everybody's focusing on what will happen at the national level. Will we have a coalition? Will the ANC come down to less than 50%? What we also have to start thinking about very seriously is the impact that this election will have on the composition, complexion, and architecture and design of the parliament. You're going to have an ANC with reduced seats. You're going to have perhaps new political parties like the MKP, Arise and Zanzi, Build One South Africa with seats in the National Assembly. It's going to have serious questions, serious implications, as well as from the 90 members that make up the NCOP, the National Council of Provinces, because that's where a lot of the bills have to also be discussed, vetted, and approved, especially Section 76 bills, which affect like your finance, anything to do with finance, money bills, etc. So for me, what's going to happen is that if you have these kinds of the kind of election outcome we're going to see, that's going to be much more fluid at the national level, it's going to be much more complex in parliament, because this is where your laws of the country are being made, debated, and passed. And I think to a large extent, it's going to impact on what's going to be key for how we move South Africa in a pragmatic way towards the attraction of business confidence, investment, etc. So there's bills that are there that I think we'll have to start thinking about the impact of this election on Parliament, which is where I am thinking it has a much more critical impact, a significant impact. And I'm not saying the national should be ignored, but I think who goes to Parliament is going to be critical.
Well, as I alluded to at the top, South Africa's constitution built around principles of cooperative government, and certainly next month's election is going to be the first real test of that ambition. Sanusha, what a pleasure it's been catching up with you today. So thanks so much for having joined us. And to our viewers, remember, this conversation is free, it's accessible, it's shareable. So please follow the conversation on various social media platforms using the hashtag ThinkBigPSG. Thanks so much for joining us today and for watching. From me, Alicia Seckham, it's bye for now.